a very good interview with you here in Palm Sunday. You know what we could do? You know, I could just ask the questions and you could read the answers right out of your book.
Well, the questions are mine. It's a completely rigged interview. It's a Paris Review does these interviews with writers, and mine went so badly, really. It was so cumbersome, done the honest way, that I asked for the opportunity to rewrite it. And so I did. I spent about 2 weeks on it, and it finally came out more or less as it should. It would have been very embarrassing if it had, if the real interview had been published.
I'm sure your questions were better anyway.
But I knew what the funny answers were.
Well, in your first book, Player Piano, you quote from Matthew in the Bible, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. Now, for a man who appears to object to organized religion as much as you do, apparently you do think that the Bible does have some good things to say.
Oh, well, how could anyone object to the Bible as literature? Is my goodness. One of the great men of all time who goes totally unacknowledged is Lancelot Andrews, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare's and who was, in fact, in charge of the translation of the Bible into King James English. And, of course, everyone assumes that this is how God talked, and God no doubt speaks beautifully, but these words happen to be Lancelot Andrews.
But it's not the Bible obviously does not carry the word of law to you.
No. Well, I honor my ancestors, as I think everyone else tries to do, and our family has been agnostic or atheistic for many generations now, and we've behaved decently and are to be trusted in business and as courageous as most people.
Well, at a Civil Liberties Union fundraiser, you spoke about Thomas Aquinas and his theory that human law was a poor relation to what he called divine law or natural law. What's wrong with this?
Well, it may be true, but the highest law we have in this country, and I say thank God for that, is human law. It's the laws we make ourselves, and Aquinas talks about other laws, which he sees as apparent. In fact, most of us do. He sees nature's laws, natural law, says that is higher than man's law, and higher than that is God's law. And, of course, he was a Catholic, and this is a Catholic point of view. If this point of view were honored in the courts, we would be in a great deal of trouble in this country. We would have a theocracy, as they do in Iran now, and priests would, in fact, be in charge of us, telling us what God's law is. And our founding fathers, while utterly respectful of God, said that we really couldn't know what God's wishes were. The only clear indications we had of, was of what men themselves needed. And so we have only the lowest form of law operating in this country, which is man's law, and that's what makes this nation such a thrilling experience, is that there are not religious people who can pull their rank on us by saying what God wants.
What do you believe the role of a theologian should be in our society, or should it have a role at all?
Well, I haven't spent much time with theologians. They are religious historians, among other things, and after all, the holy texts we have come through many languages to us, from Aramaic to Hebrew to Greek, finally to Middle English, and finally into modern English. So theologians can be very useful in going back over those old texts to see what was actually said long ago. They are historians. They can surely speculate about what God may want or what the purpose of the universe is. And, of course, I make my living the same way, as I certainly want to know what's going on, and I have a great deal of fun speculating about it.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut, what do you think causes man the most harm? Sexual excessiveness, obscenity, adherence to certain religious teachings?
Well, what is causing the most harm now, as we live in modern times, is carelessness. As in the past, a person behaving carelessly could accidentally poison one well, for instance, and there would be millions of wells left on the surface of the planet where we could still get decent water. But now, with our carelessness, with our heedlessness, we are poisoning whole rivers, as perhaps we'll poison whole oceans, as the Mediterranean is pretty well shot now. And so I think our carelessness is really doing far more damage to our health than anything else we do. Mugging is very bad, too. Armed robbery.
And you're a New Yorker, you should know.
I find this the least alarming city I've ever been in. I don't even know anyone who's been mugged. I know Andrew Stein, slightly. He was mugged, but I've lived here for quite a while, and I have seen very little ugliness. I've certainly seen a lot of poverty.
You're not afraid to walk the streets of New York?
Yes, I'm afraid, as I'm alert, and I think about it, but in fact, nothing much ever seems to happen.
As you discussed fully in Palm Sunday, Slaughterhouse 5 has been banned in one Long Island school district. It was burned in a furnace in North Dakota. But shouldn't the people who object to your writings have the right to suppress those writings if they see them as being harmful?
Not if they are public officials. As private persons, they can certainly exclude my books from their home. They can tell their children that they should not read these books. But the people who have banned these books are, in fact, public officials who are intended to represent all sorts of opinions in their community and not merely their own opinions. So any enemy of my book, as he's certainly entitled to be my enemy, but if he is an official, he has no right under the Constitution to take official action against what I've written.
Are you worried about the influence of the moral majority?
I don't know. It's like being worried walking around New York, as I haven't been hurt yet and really don't expect to be hurt. And religious conservatives have been around a long time and have done not much harm. We will have to see if they start doing actual damage. No, I'm not frightened of them in advance of the event.
From your Manhattan viewing post, do you believe that the moral majority is going to play a role in influencing the Reagan administration?
I have no idea, as we will have to see what happened. I mean, the administration just began, and so it is only talk now. Yes, it could turn very ugly, but that potential has always existed in this country. There's a potential to go fascist, to go communist, to go crazy in many ways. We haven't done it yet, thanks largely to the Supreme Court and the great keel of the Constitution.
You have kind of a wait-and-see attitude with regard to the Reagan administration, I assume.
Well, that seems only reasonable, yes.
Still on the honeymoon. No doubt a lot of people consider you profane, and in Palm Sunday you include your short story, The Great Space Fuck.
Yes, this is the first story with fuck in its title, I believe. Yes.
No doubt you've read the explicit passages in Cheever's Falconer and in Styron Sophie's Choice. Why can't fiction writers such as yourself write nice, clean books like Steinbeck did?
Well, I in fact do write nice, clean books. As it's been said that, one man who had heard that I was being censored all over the place made it his business to read everything I'd written. And he said he could learn more about sex from talking to a 14-year-old for 5 minutes than he could from reading every one of my books. There was a time when we all censored ourselves because there seemed reason to suspect that sexual scenes, dirty language, might actually upset children. And we were willing to believe that. But more and more research was done on the effects of pornography on people in lunatic asylums, people in prisons, people known to have criminal backgrounds, and ordinary people and so forth. and the evidence came in over the past 20 years that people were not, in fact, damaged by reading the word fuck, for example.
Well, you have raised 6 children. What would your reaction have been were one of your kids were to come up to you and use the word fuck? Would you have become angry? Because they're grown now, but not much you can do now. But how would you have reacted during this period when they were growing up?
Well, I suppose the problem did come up, but for one reason or another, they were most cleanly spoken, really. I suppose they experimented with the word fuck now and then. I mean, after all, their peers get to them long before the parents do, and so their peers had already told them, you know, you mustn't say this in public, or you mustn't say it to your parents.
Mm-hmm. This sexual explicitness in literature today, that doesn't bother you at all?
Yes, it offends me some. It's 42nd Street causes considerable discomfort, but it seems ugly to me. But at the same time, it seems the price we pay for the First Amendment, for the right to say anything we want to. And we want to hang on to this right, not for sexual reasons, but for political reasons, that we want to be able to speak against people who are misruling us, who are defiling the country in one way or another. And very marginally, there is the freedom to speak about sex. This is the freedom to speak about our own bodies. For one thing, 50 years ago, people had very incomplete vocabularies for their bodies. Had trouble conducting conversations with doctors and nurses and so forth about where they hurt and what the symptoms were. If the body was so embarrassing somehow and all the words were so embarrassing. So I welcome the freedom to discuss our bodies, and yes, our sex lives too. Why not?
The vocabulary is complete today.
Yes, I think so, and quite simple and clear.
I notice you are smoking, but in your book you say that you have given up booze. You used to make long-distance calls and write some crazy letters and so forth. Don't you think, under the circumstances, that the booze might be more preferable, however, to heavy smoking?
No, because, well, I suppose the cigarettes will shorten my life considerably. I've already outlived F. Scott Fitzgerald and D.H. Lawrence and a good many other people, so I'm sort of a post-grad now anyway. I've had all the time anybody should need. No, the booze damaged my mind, and it made it difficult for me to think clearly. I have enough trouble thinking clearly when I'm sober. And it also induced a lot of futile anger and so forth. So it was disagreeable.
Did you try to write while you were drinking?
Yeah, well, I think every writer has. And there's only one writer who has written well while drunk, so far as I know, is a man who wrote Under the Volcano.
But H.L. Mencken used to claim to be a heavy drinker. It may have been exaggerated, however, but he would always say that his drinking would start when he went away from his typewriter. Can't drinking still be part of life? William Styron was quoted as saying that he's a man who likes his martinis. But can't drinking be separated from a writer's work?
Yeah, well, I take drinks now and then. I just realized I was drinking too much, and so I went for a year without drinking at all, which wasn't very difficult to do, and now I do take a drink now and then. Just historically, no one has been able to write well while drunk, as I think we'd all be willing to do it and happy to do it if we could.
How did it happen that you, as a science fiction writer, cut through this category and then began to appeal to just about all segments of society, except maybe some of your relatives in Indianapolis?
Well, it was, and science fiction is an unfair literary ghetto anyway, as I was thrust into it without wishing to live in that particular part of town. because I understood something about technology and included it in my books, and the feeling still exists that anyone who knows how his refrigerator works can't possibly be an artist, too. What I was trained as an engineer and a chemist. And so when I wrote my first book, Player Piano, it was full of machinery, and it was about General Electric Company, as it was in Schenectady in 1950. This seemed like fantasy about 3,000 years in the future to persons who've never hung around in factories. And so I was unfairly categorized as a science fiction writer, and I say it was unfair because the pay was lower, much lower for science fiction writers than the supposedly true artists, the truly sensitive, creative people. I wanted to get paid as much as anybody, and I wanted to be reviewed as seriously as anybody. So I kicked about it in an essay in the New York Times. Also, I think I've taken more time with what I've written. What, in my whole life, I've written 9 novels now. An ordinary science fiction writer would do about 3 a year, I would think. And Isaac Asimov has done 5 as we sit here and talk.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut, you were working at the GE plant in Schenectady as a public relations man, and I guess that's when you started work on your first novel. But you decided to go freelance, to make this a full-time occupation for you. Now, that's a risky undertaking for many people. Did you have a grubstake, or how did you engineer
it? Well, it wasn't risky in those days. It was the golden age of magazines, and if you could write a short story, you get paid pretty damn well for it. And if Collier's didn't buy it, the Saturday Evening Post would buy it, and if neither one of them would buy it, Red Book would. And in those days, the world was a wonderful pinball machine for story writers. You know, the ball would keep bouncing down and down and down and down till somebody bought the darn thing, and that's all over with. And at General Electric, I couldn't get a raise. Because I wasn't old enough yet. It was an age-graded society, and I had a couple of kids. So I started writing short stories on weekends, and I sold my first story for 7 weeks' pay. And I sold my second story for 10 weeks' pay. You know, that was about 3 weeks later. And I suddenly had this currency piling up in the corners there, you know. $5 bills blowing all over the house, and I was wondering what the hell I was going downtown for.
It's connected to your thing.
Yeah.
You make a lot of references to being German-American, and as if you really have to defend it. Now, my wife is a German-American, and although she feels herself as being completely American, and she thinks Germany is probably incurable, and that's that. That's as far as it goes. Do you carry around with you a feeling of guilt or something for being a German-American?
I run into... No, I don't. Hell no. I haven't done anything bad. And neither have any of my relatives, but I do run into a certain amount of resentment. And, you know, people who want to tell me that they've been hurt by Germany in some way, and they can be quite unpleasant about it. And so I respond to that. The world is a zoo. I mean, this is a great, unracist city. At the same time, everybody is very clever about spotting every possible breed. You know, it's also like the Westminster Kennel Club, where everybody knows what everybody else is in pretty good detail.
I talked to William Manchester a while back, and he was saying that he harbors no resentment toward the Japanese today or the Germans today, the young ones. But whenever he runs into an older Japanese, one his age, because he was shot in the Pacific Theater, or an older German, there is a resentment there. He can sense it because they were enemies in the 1940s. And he says their relationship will never be the same. Do you have any of that feeling? You were a prisoner of war.
I was a prisoner of war, and I got to know them pretty good. I found them dumb in annoying ways, the people who guarded us. I'm again, you know, what German are we talking about? There's some very agreeable old ones, too, like Heinrich Böll and Günter Grass, who are planetary citizens and two of the most adorable people I know. So, sure, I sure like Heinrich Böll, who fought on the Russian front, and I like Günter Grass, who was a draft dodger. And, yeah, there's a couple of good Germans.
What's it like living and working in New York City? You know, a lot of authors like to tuck themselves away in little New England-type villages, but here you are in the biggest of all cities.
Well, I lived on Cape Cod for 20 years, and so I have a pretty good idea what that's like. And as long as I was young and alarmed and ambitious and all that, my surroundings didn't matter much to me. But as I got older and sleepier and all that, I really needed the excitement of a city to keep going. And specifically this city. Chicago wouldn't do it. Rome wouldn't do it. Paris wouldn't do it.
Our sirens don't keep you awake at night?
Oh, no. But this is to me, the art capital of the world. It's a thrilling place to live. And if I were still on Cape Cod, I would be asleep all the time.
How do you feel having your wife, Jill Crimmins, snap your picture every time you turn around?
Well, it could almost be made into a movie. You know, I've been just frame by frame by frame, and she keeps getting new cameras and equipment and stuff and testing it on. And I'm her test pattern again and again and again. As before she goes out to work, she fires a couple of times at me to make things out. Sure, everything is working well. It's pleasant enough.